The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. It's the 26th of March. I'm in Victor Harbour at the residence of Norm Ginn. Norm, thank you for participating in the RSL A Time to Celebrate program. Can I ask you to just tell us a little bit about where you were born and where you were from, and some early childhood memories?
Yes, I was born in Mildura, 16th of the 8th, 1923. And I grew up first 3 years in Coolog, which was about 12 kilometres out of Mildura. My father had come out from England to support his brother, who had a property at Coolog, and his brother had TB and he left to go to New Zealand. But after I was there for 3 years, he shifted to Mildura because we had he had children, 4 daughters, and he wanted them to go to high school, so we shifted to a block he bought in Mildura, a block of fruit block. I grew up, I went to school at Mildura Central and also finished up 3 years at Mildura High. I left at a year at 15 years of age. In those days it was the Depression, and of course most boys had to go home and work on farms or wherever, because of the very difficulty in living in those days, of Depression days. We had to, all the children had to work quite hard, used to help on the farm, and also as we went to school, deliver milk or butter or asparagus, or anything that grew at home to help ends meet. When the war was on at this time, of course, and I applied to join the Air Force and was accepted, worked for 6 months doing night school to bring me up to the standard they wanted. And I was accepted in December 1941, and then that was postponed when the Japanese came in the war, and I finally joined up in January 42.
Do you remember how you felt at that time? Were you anxious? Were you excited?
Well, I was keen to be in the Air Force, but my father was, of course, English, and we were real British, and of course with the war going badly, it was we all felt as boys that we had to join up to do our duty. So yes, and I liked the Air Force the best, so I joined the Air Force.
When you first joined up in January 42, where did you spend that first year? Whereabouts were you?
The first 3 months I was went to Summers down in Victoria. 3 months there doing preliminary study on maths and English and different things like that. And then I was drafted as a wireless operator, air gunner, to Parkes, New South Wales. I did 6 months there training and passed out and then came over to Port Pirie for 6 weeks doing gunnery exercises, became fully qualified as a wireless operator gunner.
Are these memories really vivid in your mind?
Yes, I can remember quite well, quite well. And after training there at Port Pirie, we were sent to the showgrounds at Melbourne, waiting to be sent either somewhere or other. And I was there for some weeks. They called for volunteers to go up to New Guinea. Nobody volunteered, of course. And so they just stuck a pen in the roll book, and the chap next to me, Golden, he was the one that was sent up there, so I never heard any more about what happened to him. But anyway, after being there for some weeks, we were 23 of us were drafted onto a small ship that used to be a 3,000 cargo one carrying meat from England to Argentina. We were signed on as civilians, so we embarked at the end of January for England. We set sail on England to pass New Zealand down to Panama on our own, a small vessel, and we had to act as gunners on the ship with their guns, their old Oricon guns. And for some were trained, they had one 4.5 big gun on the stern, and the team were trained to man that. So all the way over we took our turns and being on watch. We got to Panama Canal and went through the Panama Canal, and I was amazed how green everything was after being in the Mallee all my life. It was a beautiful country, beautiful air. We went through the Panama Canal, we went up the coast of America to New York, and all the way up there were ships with just a mast sticking out of the air because the Americans still had lights and the submarines would pick off different boats. So we saw a lot of ships with just a mast. We got to New York and we were in the bay on 42nd Street, right next to the Normandy, which was on the side. We stayed there 10 days because we must have hit a whale, which we didn't know, of course, but to fix up the damage. And so we had quite a good time at New York, visiting various places.
And whereabouts did you go? Do you remember? The main thing was
Radio City. And of course, the big buildings went up the top of them and had a look around there. But mainly, we went to Stage Shore Canteen, where we were entertained by the film stars. And I had a picture of a friend of mine, who was a film star. And he was a beautiful pianist, Ross Gregory, and he played for them while we were there. But after 10 days there, we were set sail in a convoy. We assembled in a convoy, about 40 ships, all sizes, to go up to England. But we had crept along the coast most of the way with only two corvettes to guard us. We were all in line, seven ships in each line, and we were attacked by submarines most of the every so often, and often the little ship at the end of the line, which was the smallest usually, one was sunk every now and again. But no one was allowed to stop, so we don't know whether any of those were saved or not. But those two little Corvettes to guard them. We got up to Newfoundland and we were in a heavy fog and we'd lost the convoy by then, and all of a sudden appeared a big battleship appeared beside us, but this fortunately was a British battleship. We then went from there over to Glasgow where we berthed.
You made a comment of when you made it to Panama that everything was beautiful and lush and green, very big contrast to the Mallee.
Yes.
Coming from Mildura originally, what was it like for you travelling through the Panama Canal?
Well, it was huge, of course. Everything was amazing to me because I'd never been away from Mildura, so it was something outstanding to me to go through the Panama Canal, the different lifts and the way we went from one lake to another lake, and to see the alligator slide off the edge of the lake as we went through. So it was a marvellous experience. And we went through, couldn't understand why there were stumps of lights on the way each side of the, and that was because a big battleship had gone through and they had to cut off these lights for allowing it, because it overlapped the sides. They had to take off all the lights, had to cut them off at the bottom, just stumps left as they went through. Yeah, so otherwise it wouldn't have been able to go through the canal. It was too big.
Too wide.
Yes.
Can you tell me any instances of how you would keep yourself entertained while on this convoy? What would you do?
Well, we used to walk around the boat, ship they called it, never called it a boat. We used to have to walk around the boat and do physical exercises, so we kept ourselves pretty fit on the whole. Yes, we're always doing something.
So when you set out, there was 40 ships, you said, at the start of the convoy.
Yes.
How many ships made it across?
Well, we don't know, because we finished up, as I say, on our own when we got the Newfoundland in the fog. So we had no, by that time, we were all split up, so I don't know. So we went on our own then across to... escorted by this battleship across to Glasgow.
What were some of your early experiences then in England?
Well, from there we were sent down to New Bournemouth, down south, and that was a staging camp for Air Force. First thing, we met up with different Air Force chaps, burnt faces. They'd been burnt on the face because they were flying in Wellingtons, and Wellingtons were very bad for catching fire, and that was the first thing we noticed. And then after being there for a short while, we were sent up to the Lakes District to Milham, where we did another month's course on getting on to the modern English wireless and such, which amazing to us, because the Australian ones were all where you had to change them on each frequency. You had a box-like a cylinder and you had to put that in, do that sort of thing, which was quite a difficult task. So we trained at Milham, and there, of course, the food was pretty shocking at that stage. We had a job eating a lot of it. But we used to, on leave, we'd go to the Lakes District and have a look, which was marvellous to us. We had a pretty rigorous month training on this new wireless, because it was all new to me. And when I first looked at it, I used to think, how could one man watch all this? But you got used to it after a while. And we passed out, and from there we went to Lichfield in the middle of England, and we were there shortly, and they had what they called crewing up, and you all assembled in a big hangar, and you were meant to just sort yourselves out. And fortunately, a chap came up to me and he said, would you like to be in my crew? And I said, yes. And so gradually, we formed a crew of seven.
So the crews of seven that were formed there, whereabouts did the other gentlemen come from?
Well, we had a pilot was Tom Orford. He was from Western Australia. He was a bit older than us. Tom was 23. And then our navigator was Eric Daly. He was from Western Australia, from Perth. He later became a doctor. And Laurie Leask was our bomb aimer. He came from Sydney. And then our engineer, both English chaps. Rear gunner was Tom Mason.
And your role then, wireless operator?
I was a wireless operator.
Could you explain a little bit about the space that you had to work in?
Well, first of all, we went into Wellington. That was the first plane we were, as a crew, we were trained in. We did a certain amount of time at this field. My position was in the centre, and I had the heating apparatus, and of course I operated the heating for the plane, and I used to have to turn it down because I'd get too hot. Others often complained that they weren't hot enough, but I would be cooked there. It was really very oily too, very oily. You had to be careful with the oil everywhere, and that's why so many got burned, because it was a fabric plane, fabric burns pretty easy. We trained there for a while, and then we were sent across to a centre called Blighton, which was on the coast, to train on Stirlings. So we did so long on Stirlings, training there, and went from there to Stirlings to Halifax's, and then finally we got onto the squadron around about August onto Lancaster's, a short training there before we started our operations. Yes, yeah, so Lancaster. We were on the Australian squadron 460, 460, the Australian squadron. And our CO over these three different stations was Group Up Captain Edwards from Western Australia, VC.
How many planes would be in that squadron?
Well, it was roughly 27. And the wing commander in charge of our squadron was from Mildura, same as me, but much older, of course.
Sorry, this was 1943.
Yes, all 43.
What happened next then?
Ops, for semi-ops for a while, going to different places in Germany. It'd be all long distance travelling because you never went to the target straight away. You always went left or right, trying to deceive the Germans where you were coming. So from there we went to, the last four ops were Berlin. And by that time Berlin was getting pretty difficult because we're losing so many aircraft every night over Berlin. And we would see the planes going down and think how terrible it was. We carried a very heavy load, and then sometime during that we were drafted to the Dambusters, our crew, but suddenly we were pulled off because they put us onto a new wireless and navigation equipment called H2S or Y. That was, so we were the first crew to be trained on that. So I was lucky I didn't go on the Dambusters.
Did you get used to it?
Yes, I think you never felt it was going to be you. Even though you saw planes going down all the time, you always felt it was the other fella. You were lucky that way, but by the end of the trip, your eyes were way out here because while I was acting as a wireless operator and with the new equipment which I had to help the navigator with, also acted as a lookout. And of course, by the end of the trip, your eyes were pretty strained, so we're glad to get back. But my duty when we got back was to get permission to land, and coming back on one ship, we were coming back because our skipper was always keen to get first, because if you were a bit slow, you were there for half an hour circling round. So we went in, I got permission to land, and we landed, but we landed on the aircraft next door to us. We were drones were all close to each other. And into the roadway, we went to a big ditch, had a big ditch there, and had to leave the plane, and they came and picked us up and took us back to the cab. But one trip we were set off, and we just got airborne and two engines cut out. And then the pilot aborted it and circled round, and just as we touched down, the other two engines cut out. And we don't know if it was sabotage or what it was, but we were lucky. But that's what must have happened to some of the crews, I think, because Ross Gregory, who was the one fearful pianist with me in New York, he was one of the first to go. They disappeared over the sea, and we never knew what happened to him.
If it was sabotage, who was suspected of...
Well, we don't know. You see, we all... Aircraft were parked on this aerodrome, which was originally a wheat field, and we all just had sections all around the aerodrome. So people could have come in, we don't know, could have come in, because some crews came back without the rear gunner, so we'd say some Germans living in England, joined up and was used as a spy, and he probably gave them all the information that they needed. So I would say would have been possible to sabotage the planes.
How exhausting were these ops?
Oh, pretty tough, because you were on edge all the way. You're expecting fighters to attack you and NACAC to attack you, so it was constantly. You'd come back sometimes with holes in the wing, with the NACAC. Just touch this one for you. Always were lucky until the last trip. So I was glad to be back. Yes. But unfortunately, we'd lose so many aircraft every trip. The squadron lost a lot of aircraft. So always new crew. So you didn't get to know the other crews very much, because they've been replaced pretty often. At those stages, they were losing 40 and 50 aircraft every night. Yes, that's terrible tragedy.
And now you've just made a reference to your last op.
Yes. Well, our last stop, we were going, we got to Berlin, and the aircraft had to be steady for the bomb over. Get ready to accurately drop the bombs, which was probably 20 minutes, and we were steady for about 3 minutes, so the bomb doors opened, and he dropped the bombs. Then we were sitting ducks, because the doors were so big. We used to carry a heavy load of bombs. We'd carry 4,000 pounder and 8 1,000s or centuries. It had been different trips, we took different loads. While the bomb doors were open, the pilot couldn't manoeuvre because they were so big. And of course, that's when we were attacked by these two fighters, the FO-09 and the JU-88. Two of them attacked us and hit us from the distance, because they had 0.5, whereas ours were only 303, so the rear gunner tried to keep them off, but we weren't successful. One blast went through, killed the upper gunner, who just set his up above me and set fire to the two starboard engines, which were burning fiercely. Finally, the fighters left us because we were burning so badly, and the pilot tried to keep going, but then he gave orders to abandon the aircraft, and I went down with the rear gunner. He was waiting at the rear door. He was a bit scared to jump, but the flames were getting so bad that I didn't have any hesitation in jumping. The other navigator, or the engineer and the bomb hammer, all went out the front. They go down the nose. And I would assume, we never knew till later on, the pilot probably couldn't get out, because by the time he left the controls, I would say the plane flipped, so he didn't get out. But I didn't know this till later on.
That must have been very terrifying for
well,
you.
Well, of course it is. I didn't open the parachute for quite a few thousand feet, because we were scared of the fighters, which you know as practice. So they dropped as far as you could and opened the parachute eventually. And then I looked down and I thought, I'm going to land in the lake. And I thought, oh, I wonder what I'll do because of freezing temperatures. And that. But I was hanging there for a while. Then suddenly I hit the ground. And of course I found it was all snow that I landed in. Fortunately, being relaxed, I landed quite well. I got up and then I took the parachute off and tried to bury it, but I couldn't. The ground was that hard. So I then started to make my way from there, but I could see a car in the distance with lights on, and I think it must have picked up one of the other boys. So I skirted round that and kept walking, and I walked for quite a long while, and then I took off my sparklers here, pushed them in the ground, and walked for quite a long while, and then I looked down and I thought, I could see something sparkling there in the ground, and bent down, picked it up, with my sparklers. I walked in a complete circle, unbeknown to me. And so then I decided to, I had a collar stud, which is a compass, and I scraped that clear and tried to use that, but I found that difficult in the night. And while I was doing that, I finally, I was told us to keep out of forest, but after a while I went through the forest, tramping through it, and I must have passed my mum over. He was hiding there, but he was frightened of who I was, and he never said anything. So I decided the only way I could navigate was by the North Star, which was, I knew about the stars. We'd learnt all about the North Star and that. So from there on, I walked all that night by the North Star. And by morning, it was as it came daylight, I thought I'd better have a rest. And I tried to lay down under this pine tree and tried to sleep the night. A train came by, I must have been on a railway line, and I thought I'd put a log on the thing on the line, but I couldn't find any logs, so I had to leave that go. And so next morning I got up and walked. I walked for miles, kept walking, and walked all that night. The next night I tried to sleep again, having difficulty sleeping in the cold. And then the third day I was walking along and I could in through this pine forest, and I could hear footsteps, and I looked around and there was a soldier coming with a rifle on his shoulder and he was walking the same way as I was. But I thought, well, I'll wait until he gets by and I'll tackle him if he tackles me. But he came up, the gap was pretty wide and he was over there and I was here through this breakaway between the two forests, a break. And he just walked by, never said a word, he kept walking. So I left him, let him get out of distance. And then I slept one night in the haystack of the next village. And in the morning, I got up, I made a mistake. I saw a girl delivering milk. And I should have then waited and pinched the milk, but I didn't. I just wanted to get away as quick as I could. So I walked through villages, and the little kids followed me for a while, and then they gave up. And then I passed a little tiny shop, and they had bread in the window. But I looked at it, and it was only artificial bread, so I was getting desperate for food, because we had, unfortunately, when I flew, I always flew with a bar of chocolate in my thing, and I had an escape kit, which was three linen maps and a tube of condensed milk, and a few pills for the pee in the water. But I used to drink water from the ruts in the ground. And there was always water in ruts in the ground, so I used to keep digging. But I kept going, and I'd had to cross the river one time, and there was a guard on the river, and he had about seven or eight people around him. And I thought, how am I going to get around him? But I came up casually and just sidled around the group as I was on the group. And he was so busy with them, he never noticed, so he kept going across the bridge. By the time I got across the river, there was in the distance there must have been a factory, because there was a guard at that factory. And he signaled me to stop, but by then there was a bit of a hill there. I quickly grabbed everything I had of me and ducked over the hill away, and of course he had his gear on and he couldn't run. He must have been a fairly old man, I'd say. But so I got away from him. And then I walked for many miles, and we were getting towards evening. I wanted to cross the river again. And I came through the timber, and there were a few houses there, and I walked past them. And the chap was in the backyard of one of them, and he looked up at me, and I just gave him a wave. But he must have been a soldier that's on guard there, and of course he had an old station dog and a revolver, and he quickly came on his bike and caught up to me, and I couldn't fight him off with the dog and the revolver, so that's where I was captured. Nightfall, I was captured. And they took me to a big camp they had not far away and put me in a dungeon. They gave me a bit of food, but they interrogated me. But of course, I just said a name, number, and rank, which we were supposed to do. They could speak English, the chap that interviewed me. A lot of them could speak English, apparently, quite easy. So I was put in the dungeon and I was tried to sleep that night. And about halfway through the night, they suddenly came in and took me out to a car waiting outside and put me in this car with the guards. And I was there for a little while, then suddenly they cancelled that and put me in back into the dungeon. And so I was there till I next morning. They gave me food for fatigue, and I was taken by car for a certain way, for a fair while, and then put in another cab. And then they asked me if I wanted to have a doctor for the burns. I'd be burnt a bit across the face when I jumped through the flames, but I refused to have anything. I thought it was a trick, more or less. But each time they interrogated me, but of course I kept silent all the time. From there they took me to the next, by rail, to a railway station, and I went by rail with these two guards and an officer guarding me in amongst the passengers. And we were sat away from them, and I would look out the window and all the terrific damage in Berlin, where there were teams of men, must have been Russians, all marching, all with shovels, all trying to clear the rubbish. But it was terrible, everything was flooded. And I was taken to Tempelhof Aerodrome and interrogated there again, and then put into an underground big place where they stored palaces and all that. So I had plenty of palaces to have a sleep on. And whilst I was there, an English chap was brought in, and he was with me too. And he was a chap that used to fly in planes. Because he could speak German, he'd give directions to the German fighters to put them off. And so he must have been shot down, and he and I were then put on a train down to Düsseldorf, the interrogation centre where they interrogated people. And I never saw him again. I was put into a cell on my own, and first of all, a Red Cross chap would interview you and try and get information out of you. And then from then on, I had 21 days of different officers come in and interview you, sometimes in the middle of the night. And one would be nice, the next one would be brutal, try to threaten you with all sorts of things. And this went on for 21 days. And all they gave me was a piece of bread and a bit of sort of skilly or soup, as we called it. And of course, all I had was one blanket, and a palace was full of fleas, so you had bites all over you. If you wanted to go to the toilet, you had to signal a latch on the door and they'd take you to the toilet. But towards the end, they took me out in the middle of the night, one night, and into the courtyard, lined me up against the wall, and they had four soldiers with their rifles and an officer, and stood me there for a while, and didn't say anything. And of course I thought, well, nobody knows where I am or who, the family won't know. But I just stood there because I didn't want to give in. Eventually, they must have been bluffed, because they finally took me back to the cell. And then next morning, I was taken before the commandant, and he gave me a blast and said who I think I was, and tried to frighten me, but I fortunately stuck it out. And then they sent me out to the quadrangle, and there were a whole sort of about 15 or 16 different Air Force chaps all lined up, and I met my navigator. He must have gone through the same thing, because we were on this new equipment. I think I was determined to try and get information about this HUS, or whatever we called it. But anyway, I met him, and we were taken to a small camp and given half a Red Cross parcel, which is so many of us. And that was our first decent meal for quite a long time. And from there, we were put on the train then, just stood up, no beds, just stood up in this carriage, locked in with just a bucket at the end for the toilet, and no food or anything. So we had our, most of us took a bit of our Red Cross parcel with us. Took us so many days to get to the camp, and finally we came to Muhlenberg, which we were taken off the train and all marched to the camp, which was so many kilometres away from there. Of course, we were put in this camp and we were into different huts. I was in a hut with about 110 men. The other half was about 150. And they were all mixed up with different English, Australian, and so forth. It was a big camp, and I was there for a certain while, and I decided to try and escape with my navigator, and two of us made our first attempt at the stake. We got through the first lot of wire, and getting towards the second, when unfortunately we were spotted by a guard with a dog. He must have smelt us. So we were caught, and both of us spent 21 days in solitary confinement again. And then back at the camp, eventually camp had a lot of activities, sports and studies and things like that. And then I decided, I joined the escape committee and I joined them to try and escape again. One of the ways of escaping was to wheel this wagon, be eight of us, pushing this wagon to get Red Cross passes, which they were on the outside camp corridor, up to a hut. And we'd get halfway along and we'd make out something was wrong. Two chaps had quickly cut the wire when they saw the guards walking over, cut the wire, and we'd have chaps that escaped, French clothes, because the French were our working party. They'd quickly get through and walk as though they were going out to work. So that was one of the jobs, different jobs to help different people get out. Another one was to guard to the, some chaps would go to the guard to be on the, a group that would be taken out to work parties, and you had to use an army uniform because they wouldn't let Air Force men go. They'd count them, and then just as they were moving to go through the gate, one chap would step in and join in with them, and they'd get out one every day and go that way. That was a way of getting people out. And you had to take a turn in, of course. Then, after a while, my Tom Fielder, who was a great writer of a war book, he got me into this group, and we had, were digging a tunnel. There was a hut out in the middle that was used as an education hut. And dropped down in this hut, there'd be one of our chaps on guard at the top. We dropped down, they dug a pit, and they were digging a tunnel all the way along. So our job was each day to go and dig for a while. We'd have to give them a blanket each, and had a long rope that somebody had pinched from somewhere, and we dragged the earth back. Somebody up the top would push it under the hut, all around the hut. Somebody had pinched the electric wires from somewhere, and they'd connected up lights all along the tunnel because you couldn't see in the tunnel. So they had lights there all the way. There'd be seven of us in the tunnel at the time digging. At the front, we had two Welsh miners, and they'd be digging earth and putting on a blanket, and you'd have to pull it back. because of the lack of air, some chap had pinched a hose out of the garden of the Germans, and they'd rigged a kit bag up and they made it as a pump and pumped air down to the front for these miners. Otherwise, they couldn't have stayed there for the lack of oxygen.
How did you feel being a part of that team?
I was always keen, thinking, you know, I could get out. So I was always hopeful. I was always one of those that didn't want to give in if I could get out. We dug for quite a long time, and we had got out past the garden. We had to go underneath the garden and had to go outside the field near the sentry box. But because the field had been suddenly cleared, cut the crop, whoever was in charge of ours decided to go another week further, get further out. Otherwise, we would come up by the guard's house. And of course, in that week, that's when the Germans got suspicious. They found a tunnel over the Russian compound, because we had thousands of Russians in the camp too, in a separate compound. They found this tunnel, so they must have gone searching. They saw the earth around the edge and used crowbars and pushing in. And of course, the chap on the top, our sentry, gave us a warning and several of us quickly got out, stuck up the other side of the hut and got back into the compound before they woke up what was going on. And then, of course, suddenly they woke up and they surrounded everything by... Poor old chap at the top was the only one they took to interrogate. So I don't know what happened to him. We never heard. And then the Germans filled that tunnel with sewage, filled it up with sewage, of course, because we had a sort of brick building where they were open the weather, but you sat there and went down and the Russians had to pump the stuff out into sort of wagons, round wagons, and they'd take it out into fields and spread it out. That was the sewage, yes. Of course, who knows what would have happened to us, because it was not long round about that time that Luftfried, the Great Escape, was on. Took us out that and stood us on the parade ground for the whole day, and issued us with pamphlets to say that we were shot if we were caught escaping. So possibly we would have been the same if we'd been caught. So we stood out the whole day for that. But the Germans used to search our barracks regularly, and the SS used to come in and they'd search. And one time a chap played a prank on them. They put a wire right up to the ceiling, up the top, and they had what they call a ferret, and his job was to get up to the ceiling. And of course, for doing this, we had to stand out in the parade yard all day because of this. They didn't take kindly to that. Further on, towards that, though, we had a lot of Dutch policemen in the cab, and they were in a separate compound not far from us, and they were to be taken out. Because we were short of bedboards, each one of us, we rushed over to get bedboards, but the Dutch had them piled up and wanted to sell them to us because we used to get Red Cross parcels, and there'd be so many cigarettes which he uses to try and buy stuff from these Russians who'd come back into Eastern Night, carrying lettuces or anything in the inside of the barrel, that they'd hang them there. So we used those cigarettes to try and get things to buy, but the Dutch wanted cigarettes for these bedboards, but we all grabbed them and took them off them to fix up our beds, because we only had every second board to lay on once we'd given them for this tunnel work, to shore up the tunnel. So.
How long were you a POW for?
Well, I was 18 months before finally the Russians came through all of a sudden. And they rushed through the camp. And no, Germans had gone during the night. And we woke up in the morning, we were more so, all Russians were Cossacks just on their horseback with their guns. And they came through and we were more on our own. And but they didn't have any organisation to deal with POWs. They don't treat POWs as men to them. You either died or you fought, but to them. So all the Russian prisoners in our camp all had to make their own way back to Russia. And of course, in that process, some of them went to the villages and killed the people, some of the people there. So we had to. I was one of those that had to act as a policeman to try and stop this, otherwise they would have murdered everybody. Anyway, so then we had to go out and forage food for ourselves. We'd roam the countryside, tried to get stuff where we could keep ourselves alive.
How did you get back to England then?
Well, eventually we were there for 20 odd days, a month really, foraging and coming back to camp with our food. And anyway, suddenly the Russians gathered all the prisoners up and put them in a special camp, and we didn't know what was going on. We were frightened what was going to happen. So five of us cut a hole in the fence. We still had our cutters, and we set forth and we made our way slowly back. We knew where to go and we worked our way back to the American lines. And we, on the River Elbe, the Russians were on one part of the river and the Americans the other. But the Russians didn't stop us. They allowed us to go through to the American lines. That's how we got back. The Americans took us by truck there to Halley, which was a big camp for hospitals, and they looked after us for about a week in there. They flew us back to Belgium, Brussels. We went and lied there, and then the British in Lancaster flew us back to England.
How did it feel getting into Lancaster again after all?
I had to lie down in the front because they filled them up as much as they could. So me, I had to lay down the front like the engineer. But you got to the stage you were used to anything, I think. Immune to any surprises. Yeah, that's the accepted things as you were going. And from there we were deloused and spent the night there, interrogated. And then from there we were sent down to Brighton on the coast of England and spent some weeks there on holiday leave for a while, and we could go back and visit various people. I had a local in England and I used to go and stay with him sometimes, and we waited quite a few weeks before we eventually put on the ship to go back to Australia.
What was the name of the camp?
Starling 4B.
Did your Lancaster have a name?
I've been honoured with the Order of Australian Medal too for my services to the community here, so I'm proud of that. Yes.
Norman Ginn, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for coming.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.